أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد والثناء لله رب العالمين، بارئ الخلائق أجمعين، باعث الأنبياء والمرسلين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا وحبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا وشفيع ذنوبنا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد فعجل
وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المكرمين المنتجبين، لا سيما بقية الله في الأراضين، روحي وأرواح العالمين لتراب مقدمه الفداء، ولعنة الله على أعدائهم أجمعين إلى قيام يوم الدين. For the hastening and the return of our Imam, please recite the salawat.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم.
Over these nights, we've been discussing the lives of the Ahlul Bayt in order to gain the proximity of the Divine through speaking of them, thinking of them, remembering them, and learning from them. And we've tried to outline the livelihood and the history of what happened in the lives of these Imams and what they were able to accomplish. And hopefully, through understanding their accomplishment, through understanding the efforts they put in, all dimensions of it, of course, we're able to become their true Shia, true follower. We consider the Imam of our time our Imam, not an unknown supernatural being that is not around, that I'm not in contact with, that I do not see the same way the angels are. There's a difference between them. We have angels, yes. Angels are unseen. They're not part of this material world. We do not have direct contact with them. The Imam of our time isn't such. The 12th Imam is a living Imam. There's a difference between when we talk about Imam al-Husayn salamullah alayhi and the Imam of our time. What we're trying to do over the course of these nights is to become a bit more familiar with what the Ahlul Bayt did, so that when we say that we're waiting for an Imam, so that when we say we are currently the ma'amum of an imam, the follower of an imam, that would make sense. It would make sense that we are following the trend that the Ahlul Bayt laid out for us. I've mentioned this hadith before. It's good to remember it every now and then. I don't know if I mentioned it in one of the previous nights. If I did, as the Qur'an says, فَذَكِّرْ إِن نَفَعَتِ الذِّكْرَ. Remembrance helps. Remembrance will be beneficial. Reminding us will be beneficial. Or the other verse says, إِنَّ الذِّكْرَ تَنْفَعُ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ. Reminders help. The hadith says this, that you have believers, that the absence and the presence of the imam doesn't make a difference for them. Even though the imam is not present, it's the same as though he was present. How can that happen? If we have learned what the Ahlul Bayt did, and we understand how that applies to today, and we implement it in our context, that means we are following the line of the imam of our time. Although he's not here to tell us specifically what to do, through understanding that, thinking about today, applying it, we understand and we figure out what the imam wants us to do, and we do it. The hadith mentions this. He says the difference, or there's no difference between the two, because of the ma'rifah they have, because of the knowledge they have of the Ahlul Bayt. This is the purpose. So we've talked about six of six of the Imams and eight of the Ma'sumin, the Holy Prophet, the Lady Fatima to Zahra, and six of our beloved Imams. Tonight we are going to speak of our seventh Imam, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far Al-Kadhim Salamullahi Alayh. The timing that this Imam lived in, the circumstances he lived in, were very difficult circumstances, very special, in a sense, circumstances. And he had a very difficult responsibility. A very difficult responsibility that this Imam, with all of what he had, he brought it to the scene, and he put all his effort in accomplishing that goal. And the end of it was the Shahada of our beloved Imam, Imam Al-Kadhim, in prison, in very harsh circumstances. There are reasons why the Imam is put in those circumstances. What we usually hear, or maybe the only thing we know of Imam Al-Kadhim, is that he was in prison in Baghdad. Why he was in prison? Why so many times? What happened? All we hear is he talked about ahkam, aqaid, and so on and so forth. We don't have a clear understanding of that. We want to try to talk about this a bit. The difficulty begins right at his imamah. We spoke of Imam As-Sadiq salamullah alayhi yesterday, and what we explain, we said a salawat. Was this, that the movement of Imam As-Sajjad, Imam Al-Baqir, Imam As-Sadiq had progressed such that there was a network of strong believers, believers that were following the Ahlul Bayt, not only in their ahkam, not only in their spirituality, not only in their aqa'id, but also in the social political sphere. They were following the Imams and they were spreading that message, and they progressed and started to have the message of the government of the Imam spread throughout the Islamic Empire, such that from Khorasan to Egypt, you had large numbers of people without even being those who follow the fiqh of the Ahlul Bayt, but in terms of their political inclinations, they were inclined towards the party of the Ahlul Bayt. And that's why the Ben al-Abbas were able to jump on that, hijack that movement, and establish a government in the name of the Ahlul Bayt by calling themselves the Ahlul Bayt. So there was a very huge momentum that had been built up to that point. A very serious movement. What happened was, as we mentioned, Ben al-Abbas hijacked that. So when Ben al-Abbas hijacks this movement, they know it's the movement of who? Of the Ahlul Bayt. What part of it did they hijack, brothers and sisters? Remember we said in the time of Imam Al-Baqir that there were two layers of the activities of the Ahlul Bayt. One layer were the Shias, the followers of the Ahlul Bayt, those who understood theologically the leadership of the Ahlul Bayt, those who believed from the beginning it should have been given to the Ahlul Bayt. These were one group. These were the closest in the circle. And even they had different ranks, different degrees. You have people like Jabir ibn Yazid al-Ju'fi that we mentioned a few times, his name. You had those people, then you had the average Shia. That was one group of people. The Abbasids weren't able to hijack this. These people believed that they knew who the Ahlul Bayt were. They knew who the Imams were. They knew who Imam As-Sadiq salamullah alayhi was, and that he was the Ahlul Bayt. He was the Ahlul Bayt that they were trying to establish the government. These guys weren't hijacked. Who was hijacked? Remember we said that the second layer were people that were not even theologically Shia. They didn't have all that information. The Ahlul Bayt were able to bring those people and get them closer by making them realize that in terms of what happens in their society, all the problems that exist are because the government that was supposed to be handed to the Ahlul Bayt was taken away from them. These people didn't know specifically who the Ahlul Bayt were. That's why we mentioned yesterday that Imam al-Sadiq in Arafat faced the people in four directions, three times each, shouted with the loudest of his voice. The Prophet was the Imam, then Ali was the Imam, then Hassan was the Imam, then Hussein was the Imam, but then Ali ibn Hussein, then Muhammad ibn Ali, then I am the Imam. Because people didn't know. They knew the Ahlul Bayt, they'd heard something about the Ahlul Bayt. They didn't know who is of the family of the Holy Prophet that should take this on. That layer of the movement of the Ahlul Bayt was hijacked. They were a larger mass. They were taken, troops, armies, attacking the Umayyads. They took over. Now that they've come to power, they know that the Ahlul Bayt have this network. They know that the Ahlul Bayt have a goal of establishing their government. What are they going to do? They're going to consider them, they're going to consider Imam al-Sadiq their worst enemy. All right? We explain all of this now that we're understanding where we left off. There's something else that we need to add to the picture so we can understand Imam al-Kadhim's story from the beginning, when the day that he becomes the Imam. With the animosity the Abbasids had against the Ahlul Bayt, knowing that they're definitely working on developing the Islamic government that is Alawi, not Abbasi, knowing that, they use different tactics, especially after getting rid of some of the other figures, other individuals that were competing with them in power. You know, when a new government comes in, after sort of like a coup, other people start getting ideas, oh, maybe I can overthrow this government. So there's a power struggle. You have people from the clan of Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba, children, grandchildren of Imam al-Mujtaba, they want to try to take over the government. Some of the other Abbasids want to take over the government. Out of all of those, the Abbasids that had hijacked the movement of the Ahlul Bayt, they successfully got rid of all those other competitors in power. They got rid of them. But who remained? The main people, Imam al-Sadiq salamullah alayhi. So, the focus becomes the movement of the Ahlul Bayt. Alright? The focus becomes the movement of the Ahlul Bayt. Now that the focus is the movement of the Ahlul Bayt, what's the main goal? You got to try to stop this and crush it. They tried and tried and tried through sending the Imam into exile, banning him from speaking. They tried different things. They realized they haven't been able to stop it. They couldn't do what the Umayyads, what Yazid did to Imam al-Husayn, because they knew what the results were going to be. What did they do? They poisoned the Imam. So people wouldn't realize, or be difficult to say it's them who killed the Imam. They made it seem like, oh, he died a natural death. That's what they made, tried to make it, their propaganda machine tried to make it that it was natural death. When Imam al-Sadiq was assassinated in that way, how does Mansur feel? Any of you? How would Mansur, the Abbasid Khalifa, how would he feel? What would be his greatest fear? The greatest fear that he would have would be the continuation of that movement. That's the greatest fear. When you have a movement, the leader of that movement is key. You try to get rid of the head of that movement, the leader of that movement. But if there is another leader that replaces that, the threat still remains. The Zionist regime, they got rid of Sayyid Abbas al-Musawi. Why? You hit the head of the movement to try to stop this. But they made a big mistake because Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah became the next leader. Of course, all of this being under the leadership of Imam Khomeini and then Ayatollah Khamenei. But the local leadership, they got rid of Sayyid Abbas al-Musawi thinking that's it. But Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah came forth. And actually the movement started picking up speed. If you're able to hit the leadership and not have a replacement, you have succeeded. An example that many of the brothers' memories may be, for some of the brothers from Pakistan, when they assassinated the local leadership there, Shaheed Arif Al-Husseini, the goal and objective was to crush the movement in Pakistan. Unfortunately, to an extent, they were successful, because the leadership that was supposed to be there was not the same as Shaheed Arif Husseini. If you have the same leadership continuing, then you have a threat. Otherwise, when you get rid of the leader, it's a big problem for movements, for good movements, Islamic movements. If they can get rid of the leadership, they've crushed the movement, unless the leadership continues. One thing that the Abbasids didn't know, and a lot of us also don't know, of course, two different things. One thing that the Abbasids didn't know, and one thing that we don't know. What did the Abbasids not know? The Abbasids didn't know if there is a next leader or not. Mansur al-Dawaniqi didn't know that there is a seventh imam. He didn't. Now, in order to understand that, we need to understand something that we usually don't know. There are not too many ahadith from the Holy Prophet and the earlier imams that stress on who the imams are exactly by name. We don't have too many of them. And the imams didn't stress on who these imams are. I always had that question. When you're debating theologically with Ahlus Sunnah, for example, for those who are questioning, many times, brothers and sisters of Ahlus Sunnah, they're simply questioning, because what they've heard is something completely different. You're saying the lineage of leadership should have been something else. Proof, please. Evidence, please. Then when you want to find something that they accept from the Holy Prophet with all the names, you start to struggle. Now, it's there in some of the books, but it's more difficult to find. If the imams were that important, the question, sort of legitimate question that is asked, is, okay, if this was so important, why don't we have 50 of these ahadith? Why don't you have 200 of them? Explicitly mentioning the names and their role in a very, very clear fashion. Well, there's a reason for it. The reason is, this is a political struggle. You can't mention all of that. Those are secrets. You don't talk about, oh, you know what? I'm going to give you that information. Hey, CIA, if this guy is killed, okay, next guy is this. You don't give that information out. You keep it secret. When Imam al-Sadiq was passing away, he's waiting. He told the governor, you've heard this part of the story. This explanation was to give this and have an understanding of it. He told the governor of Medina, whoever the wasi of Ja'far ibn Muhammad is, behead him on sight. Okay. Wait for that will to be released. Kill him. Imam al-Sadiq, salamullah alayhi. And Imam al-Kadhim and the network of Shia, the movement of Shia, guided by these imams, was able to come out of this successfully. What did they do? They did a few things. One of them, I'm sure all of you know. When they got the will, they saw Mansur al-Dawaniqi was the first wasi. Second wasi, the governor of Medina. Third, a woman. Fourth, a woman. Fifth, Musa ibn Ja'far. Okay. Now that will be a little difficult. That will be a little difficult. But I was thinking to myself, if you get a will like that and you're in a political war, it wouldn't be too difficult to find out who is the real wasi here. Would it be? Huh? Like, okay, he put my name as the wasi. I'm definitely not his wasi. I know that. We're enemies here. The wali, the governor of Medina, he's definitely not. Are you joking, kidding me? He killed the imam. He can't be the wasi. Women, we know they're not going to be because that's not how it works. And the last one is Musab ibn Ja'far. Okay, so there you go. That's the guy. There's other things that are involved. As I said, don't think the way you think today. You think that it was clear who the next imam is, who the next leader is. No, it wasn't clear at all. It was not clear if this movement is even going to have a next leader. One of the things the imam did was to word the will in that way, to make it a bit confusing. It seems like there was something else that the imam, a couple of other things that Imam al-Sadiq and Imam al-Kadhim together did. What is it? One of them seems to be this. Now, I can't say for certainty this first one was something planned by Imam al-Sadiq, but something tells me it very probably was, but not definitely. I'm not going to say that this is definitely done. One of the things we see in history is that, look, let me describe the scene a bit better so then we can maybe understand it more in context. It wasn't only Mansur al-Dawaniqi who didn't know who the next imam is. This is part of what the imams did. The Shias didn't know who the next imam is either. I'll tell you a story, I'll get to that. But the Shia were also struggling. They didn't know. We have a list of hadith. Go check the book Al-Kafi. When it comes to the imama of Imam Al-Kadhim, it says that people were struggling. They didn't know. There wasn't a clear message sent by Imam al-Sadiq about this. Before understanding the political scene, when I looked at that history, I was baffled. I was thinking, why didn't the imam just release the name? You know, the people need guidance, spiritual guidance only. That's the only thing we're thinking of. Spiritual guidance, ahkam. Ahkam, just tell the people who's the next person. That's all you got to do. Spiritual, just tell them. But no, there's a reason why the imam hasn't released it. It's not supposed to be known. He hasn't even told many of his close companions. I'll give you their names a bit. But just understand this, that many people are wondering. There's only a few people that know that it's Imam al-Kadhim that's the next imam. Most people, even the Shia, even the ones that believe in the imama of the Ahlul Bayt, don't know who the next imam is. So what happens, this is the part that I'm saying, I can't say for certain, but there's a very good chance, in my mind at least, that maybe this was something planned out by Imam al-Sadiq, or if it wasn't, it's part of the divine plan. What is it? Other people started to claim imama. Other people started to claim that they are the next leader. Now they're making themselves the target of the government, of course. Now, one person in particular is the one that I'm thinking maybe this was actually done intentionally by the imam and it wasn't released, the information wasn't released because the imams were under severe taqiyya. It might have been the case and we didn't get any information of this. Who is it? The son of the imam, Abdullah al-Aftah. The son of the imam claimed imamah. He claimed he's the imam. People started going to his house, gathering, or pledging allegiance even with him. The companions, this is the second thing, as I said, that the imams did. Companions were lost. They didn't know. There's an account, a story mentioned in Al-Kafi that explains. Hisham ibn Salim. We have two Hishams that are known. Most of the brothers and sisters have heard the other Hisham, and that is Hisham ibn Hakam. Okay. Hisham ibn Hakam was a theological student of Imam al-Sadiq. Okay. There's another student of Imam al-Sadiq. His name is Hisham ibn Salim. Hisham is more known in jurisprudence, in hadith. He's well known there, but not in theology. Hisham says, along with some of the others, there's another figure that we have the companions of Imam al-Sadiq, his title was this. He was called Mu'min al-Taq. Mu'min al-Taq. He was a very interesting character. He had a lot of courage, a lot of bravery, and he would go engage in debates, in heated debates, and he would defend the Ahlul Bayt. He was known in different circles. Hisham says, me and Mu'min al-Taq and a few other people, we were wondering, we didn't know who the next Imam is. We came back from maybe that same day after the burial of the Imam, or a few days, wondering what should we do. He says, we went, we saw, okay, one of the people who's claiming Imam is who? Abdullah al-Aftah. He said, we went to his presence. We asked him, we asked him a couple of fiqh questions. Now these are students of Imam al-Sadiq, they already know their fiqh. They were testing him. They asked him a couple questions about zakat. The answers were wrong. When they got the wrong answers, like, okay, this guy can't be the Imam. This guy is not Imam. They came out. He said, we were crying in the streets. We were crying in the streets. We didn't know who to go to, where to go to. Are we crying that the Imam is not around? Are we crying that we're not in touch with the Imam? And true believers, they're lost, they're crying, they're in tears. They said, they were telling each other, they said, who should we go to now? It's lost, the whole cause is lost. What are we going to do? We don't know who the Imam is. They're in tears, crying. He says, we were in the streets, crying. And look, tears, crying, if you really want help, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala sends help. Right? This is a side point that's very important. If you really want, you need something, and your heart breaks and you shed tears, asking Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for help, especially if it's the cause of the Ahlul Bayt, especially if a person is struggling in order to be some of those or one of those who is pushing the agenda of the Ahlul Bayt forward, and they're struggling on that path. Not just simply because my car broke down or I lost a job. These are okay, you can break in tears and cry, that's fine. Do that. But let's try to be like the real Shia. Okay. Not when I lose my phone I cry. When I lose my Imam I cry. We're the first type. We don't really get upset. We really don't get upset. I'm talking about myself, I'm not blaming you guys, really. Every day, the hadith says when the occultation happens, you should be praying and pleading and wanting the return of the Imam morning and night, day in and day out. What I'm busy, my mind is busy, is the next car, the next new phone that's coming out, the next whatever is coming out, or how much I'm going to get out of this business, or these are the things we're worried about. He says, we were crying. He said, this guy came over in the street and he pointed to me and he said, come. I told Mu'min al-Taq and the other guy, said, you guys hide. This is probably one of the spies of Mansur al-Dawaniqi. He saw me. I've been spotted. I'm probably going to be beheaded. You guys hide, okay? You guys don't get involved. I thought I was gone. I thought this guy is one of the spies. And this shows how terrible and how terrifying the circumstances were. Somebody's just telling him to gum, and he says, I thought this is a spy, one of the agents of Mansur al-Dawaniqi. They weren't hallucinating there. Those were the circumstances. In Medina, Shia, they would be called by somebody, oh my God, I'm gone. Okay. Salams to my family. So I followed him. We went in the streets of Medina. We got to a door. He said, enter. He said, I went. Musa ibn Ja'far salamullah alayhi is sitting there. Okay. Musa ibn Ja'far is sitting there. And you know what he tells him? The Imam is showing him, guiding him in all secrecy. Remember in the street when they were crying, they were saying, we don't know who to go to. They mentioned a few names. They said, should we go to the Murja'ah? These are certain ideologies that existed at that time. Should we go to the Murja? Should we go to this group? Mufawwidha? A few different titles were thrown out. Now, the Ithna Ashari or the Shia has been lost. Should we go to the Murja? Should we go to this? So as soon as I entered, the Imam said to me, La ila al Murja'a. Don't go to the Murja'a. I didn't say anything to him. You don't need to go to Murja'a. You don't need to go to this. You don't need to go to that. Ilayya, ilayya, ilayya. Come to me. He's been singled out. One person is gone. But still, see, in the house of Imam al-Kadhim, look at the way this conversation continues. He said, at that point, I didn't feel like he's my Imam. But I had a question. When he said all of this, I'm baffled. I'm questioning in my mind. What's going on here? He's not clear. What is happening? He said, I asked him, are you my Imam? Says the Imam said, I never said that. In his own house, he doesn't even want to say, I said, I am the Imam. Hisham says, I thought to myself, I didn't word this correctly. I said to him, is there an Imam upon you? Do you have an Imam? He said, no. He said, as soon as he said no, suddenly I felt this strong faith and attachment to this man. I realized he is my Imam. Okay. These are the circumstances. Mansur doesn't know Imam. This is the meaning of taqiyya, okay? Taqiyya wasn't, as we said, praying like that. This is taqiyya. The movement, the leadership of the movement has got to remain hidden for a while. So they think that they got rid of it. It's done. They don't know. Imam al-Kadhim is gradually going to come up, come forth, and lead this. Hisham asks, can I tell others? He said, only the people that you know have the wisdom not to spread this information. This has got to remain secret. This is how the Imam of Imam al-Kadhim begins. What does the Imam do? Remember that struggle? The Shia, the network of the Shia, all of that which we have talked about. Imam al-Kadhim is going to push this forward in very, very tough circumstances. In very difficult circumstances. He doesn't want to maintain this. Look, this is very huge if we understand what we're talking about. There is already a movement that's been handed over to him. For a while, that leadership is not known. He wants to take this movement over as the leader and continue, not just maintain the numbers of Shias that you have. The Shias that are Shia in every way, and every sense of the word, not just theological Shias, not just juridical and jurisprudential Shias, social political Shias as well. This has got to expand. This needs to continue. The struggle of Imam to be the Imam of the Islamic Empire, of the Muslim nation, is continuing. Imam al-Kadhim is going to continue that. It's very tough. With the Abbasids that know what the Imams were up to, and Abbasids that now he has gotten rid of all of the other people who were debating with him. He was struggling, and there was a power struggle between them. He got rid of all of them. Very ruthless killings. They say when Mansur al-Mal'un, this is a very filthy person, it reminded me of Saddam when I heard that, maybe even worse than him. Said when he died, they found this place in his palace. When they opened the gates, it was loaded with skeletons. He would throw people in there that were against him and shut the door. Loaded with skeletons. God knows how many thousands of people were there. His own relatives. His own relatives. Power is very filthy and dirty. Okay. If somebody wants unauthorized, illegitimate power, they'll do anything. Killing is easy. Killing is easy, very easy. Relatives, oh, it doesn't matter. Anyone that stands is a threat in those circumstances, with this mal'oon, Imam al-Kadhim has to lead this movement without having too many of these Shias getting killed, the movement increasing, expanding, moving forward. It's a very, very difficult struggle that the Imam goes through. But he continues that. He doesn't say, okay, you know what guys, done, it's taqiyya time, let's just stick to ahkam, hadith, tafsir of the Qur'an, let's just forget about politics now. No, he doesn't do that. He continues that. It's interesting, some of the things that we have. I'll give you some examples of the struggle and the political movement of the Imam. As the leadership of the movement. One of them is this. Companion says, I went into the room of the Imam. You know what he saw? It was interesting. It was very interesting to see that the Ahlul Bayt, their thought, the way they did things, some of the things we see today, some of what may sound to us as very nice, some of these things were implemented back then. Particularly what I mean is symbolism. Okay. Symbolism. Symbols. Symbols are very important. They are reminders for the individual themselves and for others. There are reasons why there are Western symbols that go and are spread throughout the globe. There's a reason why that big yellow M of McDonald's has to be in Mecca. It has to be in Medina. It has to be in the Middle East. It has to be throughout the globe. These symbols have to be there. Symbols are important. Sha'airillah. Sha'air is a Quranic concept. What type of symbolism are we talking about? The companion says, this shows like the Imam is considering himself a mujahid in the real sense of the word. Not that he pull out a sword and he fought, but he has a revolutionary mindset and he's the leader of a revolution. He has symbols for that. What are the symbols? The companion said, I went into the room. You know what I saw? He said, I saw what would be translated today as military clothing hanging. Okay, it's ready. Military, ready for war. Okay. Ready for battle. The clothing is there, it's hanging. And there's a sword hanging as well. Not one of these swords that, you know, some brothers and sisters have in their homes that is useless. No, a real sword. It's a symbol of a movement. And the Quran, the book. Ideology. That symbolism is there. When you enter the room of the Imam, okay, this is the leadership of a revolutionary movement. Some of the other things we see that, let me mention this before I explain the particular example that I'm saying. Usually we hear which Khalifa, when we talk about Imam al-Kadhim, we usually hear Harun, that is known as Harun al-Rashid, who they say is buried by Imam al-Ridha. That's the Khalifa we usually hear. Imam al-Sadiq was martyred in the year 148. Last night I made a mistake, and that's what the confusion was. I was saying it's between 137 and 8. It was wrong. It's 148. The 8 part was right. The 30 was wrong. It's 148 that he was martyred. 148. For about 35 years, close to 185, after the Hijrah, is the Imam of Imam al-Kadhim. 10 years is with Mansur. It's about 35 years. About 10 years of that is with Mansur al-Dawaniqi, who's assassinated Imam al-Sadiq. And you could imagine what that means, 10 years with the person that killed Imam al-Sadiq. The Khalifa that's known as Mahdi, a year or so with another Khalifa of the Abbasids that's referred to as Hadi, And the last one is Harun for about 12 years, approximately. All right. So Harun is the last one. The struggle that the Imam had was a very tough struggle. Okay, he's pushing a political movement forward in these very harsh circumstances. He's very tactful. The Imam is very tactful in how he does things. Recite the salawat, please.
Thank you. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil faraja.
He's very tactful, and that's why Mansur, who killed so many of his enemies, threw him in that room. For that reason, the tactfulness of the Imam, and also the difficulty of dealing with that movement. It's not easy, even when you know this Imam is actually actively involved in a political struggle to overthrow your government, when you know that, but because this is a serious movement, there's a large mass behind it, it's difficult to deal with the leadership. Let me throw this in there as well and provide a bit of understanding on that. Some of you may have, if you have studied the history of the Islamic Revolution, one of the questions that comes to my mind, and it comes to a lot of people's minds, it came to my mind as well, is why didn't the Shah just kill Imam Khomeini? Why didn't he just kill him? He's causing all this trouble. Just get rid of him, kill him. When you don't have a large following, when there isn't a large group of people, a large number of people, masses, that follow a leader like that, you can do something like that. It's possible. It's easier. That's why, unfortunately, the great Shaheed, Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, rahmatullah alayh, was martyred. There's a number of different reasons. I don't want to say this is the only reason. There are a number of different reasons. One of them being, seeing the revolution in Iran, they thought that there's no way we're going to allow anything like that in Iraq, so they killed him. But the other reason was this. The movement in Iraq was still too premature for the government to fear Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr too much. They had the fear of it becoming something that is problematic, but it hadn't arrived there yet. They imprisoned him. Gradually, they saw that people are not uprising. A few people here and there, they were able to disconnect between the Hawza in Najaf and Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, which is a long story why that happened. But when they saw, okay, he's imprisoned a couple times, now it's taken a bit of time, nothing's happening, let's finish it right here before it becomes a bigger problem. You can do that when a movement hasn't really developed that much. It's easier. It's easier to do that. But when you have a much more serious movement, masses that are following, you think twice about doing something like that. That's why they poisoned the imams, and they poisoned them in ways that were not easy to trace. And then after the demise of the imams, they would come and show the people, look, he died of natural death. They would do that after every one of the imams. They would go and say, look, he passed away and it was natural death. Some of the imams is difficult. When you want to do the masab, you don't find anything. Imam al-Baqir, some have said, we're not even sure if he was shaheed. He was definitely shaheed. But they hide it. Okay, it's difficult to deal with a leadership of such a movement. So with all those difficulties and the tactfulness of Imam al-Kadhim, he went through the time of Mansur al-Dawaniqi, the next Khalifa, Harun al-Rashid, known as al-Rashid. He was a bit more clever, a better politician. So he's seeing the trend. He's seeing that two of his predecessors that were Khalifas for 10 years were struggling with this man. His movement still continues. What does he try to do? He tries to do what many powers and superpowers try to do. He tried to play nice. He tried to play nice. As soon as he came in, he said, okay, let's change the strategy. They were very harsh on the imam. It didn't work. They weren't able to crush the movement. Let's play soft now. Show kindness. Maybe we can buy him off. Oh, they had no clue. But this is something people do. And it's very difficult for leaders of movements. They come, they try to, in different ways, very tactful ways, try to say that we're genuine. Yeah, we're showing kindness, this, that, the other. But it's not genuine at all. It says Harun went for Hajj and he went to Medina. He invited many people. He invited Imam al-Kadhim as well. Imam al-Kadhim is a much better politician, of course. As Amir al-Mu'mineen said, we don't play dirty tricks, but when it comes to politics, we are the best politicians. Okay. So he thought, let's invite him over. And so what the Imam did, just try to picture this, or I try to picture it in today's terms. A very powerful ruler of a very rich country. In that day and age, it was the Islamic Empire. Okay, we don't realize this. That was the superpower of the time. The Islamic Empire was the superpower of the time, with all the wealth that it had. And where does that go? To the ruler, unfortunately, because it's not a just system. It wasn't the Islamic system. If you want to compare that today, you would have to go, well, I guess, to the superpower of the time, the United States government. And, well, right now we see the president as being the guy. Okay, this is where the White House and the luxuries and so on and so forth. Imagine somebody being invited to the White House. Okay, and the person really has to go. Now, in America, we don't have this situation. At least we haven't come to that yet, where you would have to attend. I haven't reached such a conclusion. Okay, we have to attend. No, it sends the wrong message. But some people may be invited, and you feel like, okay, this is a must. If we don't go, it's going to kill the cause. How would you go? I know people just go buy entire new sets of clothing. Okay. Expensive clothing. All right, this is serious, man. You want to walk into some of these fancy hotels in regular Islamic conferences, you're all dressed up. Okay. You're talking about the White House. You're going to spend maybe a couple thousand, maybe more than that, just on the clothing. The car that's going to take you there, the way you're going to enter. You know how the Imam went? Oh, he's sitting there, everybody's dressed up and so on and so forth. He went in on a donkey, dressed in very regular clothes. Very regular clothes. And now, obviously, Harun is kind of baffled. You know, this is kind of disrespectful here. But he's trying to show kindness. He controls himself and he tells him, please don't come off of your animal. Please come all the way close to me and get off the animal here. He wants to show respect. And the Imam doesn't say no, and so no, he comes right there. It's very disrespectful, okay? He goes with the animal and he gets off the animal there and he sits. And so he asks him, how are things, and so on and so forth. It's baffling when you hear what the Imam tells them. Okay, the Imam says, yeah, life is really tough. I got a lot of children. Expenses are high. I don't have enough. And Imam al-Kadhim, they never asked anybody for help. Now you're going to Obama and saying, please help? Obama of the time. To understand your Imam. Yes, this is what he did. What's he trying to do? He's trying to show that all of this is a game. It's a play. You're making all this up. Don't fool me. You can't fool me. He talks to him about that and he shows loads of respect. Harun shows loads of respect. But you know, when it comes to pain, This is one of the ways that rulers buy people off. They send sometimes big checks. Okay. Nice payments. There's no note on it to say this or that. If you just take it, that means you're not going to say certain things. Okay. Now, obviously, in that type of a setting, what's custom is that this ruler is going to give some money out here to the different people that he's invited. That's customary. Now, the imam has told him about his struggles, his financial struggles. Okay, he wants to show that this guy. Naturally, if you have a bunch of people you've invited over, okay, and you want to give them money, and you've shown a lot more respect to a certain person, what is that going to naturally translate into financially? It means you're going to give a bigger check to this guy, right? Especially if he says, actually, I have a lot of expenses as well. Khalifa gives everybody 200 gold coins, he gives Imam 20 gold coins. Imam takes it and leaves. The Imam knows what he's doing, the Abbasid Khalifa knows what he's doing. When the session is over, the son of the Abbasid Khalifa says, "What was all this about? He was so disrespectful, but you treated him like this, you gave him this, what's going on? Why didn't you give him more?" This is a sign that what we're saying about the political struggle of the imams. Imam al-Kadhim was part of this. He was a very tactful, very strong, very brave leader of a political movement, a very serious political movement. Harun said, if I would have given him more, he would have paid militias in Khurasan to come and fight us. Harun knows that the Imam is the leader of a movement. You don't financially help your own enemy. Imam showed him, you know, don't try to play games with me. Don't try to play games with me. Imam al-Kadhim, Salamullah alayhi, had a very difficult struggle. I'll mention one other thing before I mention some of the difficulties and examples of the difficulties. There's another front that sort of opened up during the time of Imam al-Sadiq, but it carried over to the time of Imam al-Kadhim and Imam al-Ridha as well. One of the things, if you remember, we said is part of that political movement is to give the ideology, the Islamic ideology to people. People need to be believers to be part of this movement. This is different than a political party in the West. This is different than the Communist Party. You need to be a believer in Islam. You need to be spiritual. Of course, actually, there's a similarity. If you look at the Communist Party, it wasn't just a political party. It came with an ideology as well, didn't it? You had to believe in that. Just recently, the Chinese government, I mentioned it, they banned fasting for the Muslims. The 45% population Muslim in the northwestern region of China. And they said because the ideology of the state is atheism, comes with an ideology. The Islamic political movement comes with an ideology. If you go off course on that, then you've lost it. Why was it that the symbol of the movement, we said the Imam had three symbols in the room. One was military clothing, the other was a sword, but the third was the Qur'an, ideology. When Imam al-Sadiq salamullah alayhi was passing away, he gathered his sons. In front of his sons, Imam al-Baqir, excuse me. When Imam al-Baqir was passing away, he gathered his sons and he had a box. He gave it to Imam al-Sadiq. He said, son, you're the next Imam, take this. It was books, this is a symbol. This battle is one that is heavily ideological. The ideology is extremely important in this. The enemies, becoming more aware of what the circumstances are, they realize that with the ideology, the real Islamic ideology, this applies today as well, okay, just try to take the lesson yourself, we don't have too much time. With the true Islamic ideology, there's fear. You're going to develop a movement against the government. What do we need to do? Create deviant ideologies, translate philosophy into the language. I am 100% pro-philosophy. Okay, of course it needs to be used at in the right way. But the reason why it was translated into Arabic from Greek was to counter the movement of the Ahl al-Bayt. There's a hadith on this, there's historic evidence. At least that's one of the views that's there. And this wasn't the only one. There are loads of different ideologies, different forms of atheism, different forms of Islam that were introduced into that society to confuse people. To confuse people. Why? Did they care what ideology people had? No, they didn't care. What they cared was that this ideology leads to a revolution. We got to get people off this ideology. Imam al-Kadhim had to fight on that front as well. Recite a salawat, please.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajjal farajah.
The struggle of the Imams to teach the true Islamic ideology, whether it's the ahkam, the aqa'id, the theology of it, the akhlaq of it, all of that is because this, well, amongst other reasons, not the only reason, but this is also something that's part of this movement that would lead to the government of the Ahlul Bayt. Now, the struggle of the Imam was very difficult. In what ways? I'll give a couple of examples. There are things about the life of Imam al-Kadhim that we're completely unaware of. There were times that Imam al-Kadhim had to go without being recognized, without people knowing who it is, and take care of what he needs to take care of. He had to be in hiding, carry out his responsibilities in hiding. Couple of examples. When Harun became the Khalifa, he went to Mecca for Hajj. He wanted to see Imam al-Kadhim. The Imam was in Mecca. In Masjid al-Haram, he went to Harun, Imam al-Kadhim, went to Harun, challenged him, proved him wrong politically, sat him where he belonged in front of everybody without being known that this is Musa ibn Ja'far, salamullah. There is information that sometimes the Imam would be somewhere in Sham and people didn't know. The Khalifa would send people, where is Musa ibn Ja'far? We're not finding him. Spies go around, where is he? What's he doing? Scared to death, freaking out. What's going on? What's he up to? Sending people around. In Sham, not only in Sham, look, we're thinking the Imam in Medina, called over to Baghdad, which I'll talk about. But no, Sham. The Imam has visited there. He went into a cave. There was a Christian man there. He converted the man into Islam. He became Muslim, the Christian. He went to Tabaristan, which is northern Iran. Mazandaran and Gilan together is called, back then it was called Tabaristan, apparently. Deylam, Tabaristan, that area. He was over there anonymously. Nobody knew him. God knows what this Imam did. The details of this movement, much of it is really not evident in history, unfortunately. But there are signs. And the Imam had to be in complete secrecy, alone, going around. Somebody saw him that knew him. He told him, or maybe the Imam introduced himself, and they came to know that this is Musa ibn Ja'far, this is the Imam. The Imam told him this, look at the type of secrecy, look at the form of taqiyya. The Imam tells him, if they come and ask you about me, completely deny you even know me. Completely deny you even know me. But with all these struggles that the Imam did, obviously, going to make the circumstances tougher and tougher. All of those khulafa that we mentioned, the four khalifas that the Imam lived through, every single one of them called him over to Baghdad. They imprisoned him temporarily. Sometimes they sent him into exile. And lastly, Harun called him over to Baghdad. according to some accounts, on a few occasions he was imprisoned. The last one, the purpose of it was to kill the imam. And the imam, even in prison, carried out his responsibilities. And I'll briefly just state that. I didn't maybe talk about the effect of what the imam did. I talked about his personal struggle, but the effect. The effect was that network of the Shia gained more and more strength. Now he had, Imam al-Kadhim had official representatives in different cities of the Muslim Empire. That's pretty serious. The opposition of the government has gained so much strength. He has official representation in Baghdad, in Kufa, in Ahvaz, in Qom, in Qazvin, apparently, and some other cities as well. These were only some. It's not exhaustive. The Imam, the movement had progressed to an extent where some of the top officials of the government of Harun are Shias. You all know his name, Ali ibn Yaqtin. He's got a very high rank in that government. The Imam has infiltrated the government of Harun with all the difficulty. Look at that bravery, tactfulness, strategy, you name it. All these qualities, we are not familiar. Because of this, it is that the Imam is taken. In prison, he carries out those responsibilities as well in many different ways. One of them is by creating problem for them in prison. The Imam would convert the most corrupt women that were sent to act in ways to corrupt the Imam. They would become worshippers in prison. Okay. Even there are different dimensions of his responsibility the Imam is fulfilling. They had to, in the end, the Mal'oon, Sindi ibn Shahak, the last person who was the prison guard that the Imam was given to, he put the Imam in solitary confinement in a very, very terrible circumstance. It was beneath the ground, God knows how many levels beneath the ground, a small sort of like a hole even in the ground. These are the circumstances they put your Imam in. Okay. Where there was not space to comfortably lie down or sit. And above his head was covered and only a small hole for him to breathe. Okay. This is what your Imam had to go through. Okay. For the sake of Islam, for the sake of the movement of Islam, and he still continued. He still continued. See, his circumstances were so harsh. And this man is so spiritual. The family members of Sindi ibn Shahak, the Mal'oon who poisoned the Imam, his own children looked at the Imam. They would sometimes lift that to see where the Imam is, and they would see him and it would hurt them. They felt terrible. And some of them were actually affected by it. In the progeny of that man, there were very great ulama of the Shia. Look at the effect of your Imam. Got to try to become just a bit more like our imams, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum. Ya ahla bayt al-nubuwwa wa mawdi'a inshallah, in the near future, we recite this ziyarah, ziyarat jami'ah in Kadhiman, in the beautiful shrine of our beloved Imam, Imam al-Kadhim, ruhi fida. السلام عليكم يا أهل بيت النبوة وموضع الرسالة ومختلف الملائكة ومهبط الوحي ومعدن الرحمة وخزان العلم ومنتهى الخلم. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon you, my beloved Holy Prophet, and the Ahlul Bayt. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon you. It was in your homes that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blessed us with guidance and revelation. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon you. Angels descend upon you day in and day out, seeking permission before entering upon you. Sallallahu alayk ya Aba al-Hasan ya Musa ibn Ja'far ayyuha al-Kadhim يا باب الحوائج. You know, Imam al-Kadhim is known as Bab al-Hawa'ij. With all the struggles that he went through and all the difficulties he went through, no wonder he's Bab al-Hawa'ij. He's capable and able to give you whatever you request, interceding for you before Allah. روحي لك الفداء Imagine your beloved Imam in the dungeons so low beneath the ground, no comfortable seating. He had to either stand or barely sit. Some accounts say even breathing was difficult for the Imam. Add to that all the chains, the heavy chains they had on your beloved Imam. The account says, Salamullahi alayk. Imagine your Imam being brought out. You know, these years he hasn't been fed properly. He hasn't had proper oxygen in the room. He hasn't had sunlight. He's gotten very weak. Lying down, covered with chains, being fed the poison. In the loneliness of the dungeons, there was no one there with your beloved Imam. The heaviness of the chains didn't even allow him to move too much of the pain of the poison. روحي لك الفداء. Brothers and sisters, the toll the dungeons took on your Imam was such that when they brought the body out to hand over to the Shia to go and bury,
They say, we saw a board coming out, being held by some of the prison guards. But we kept looking to try to find a body on top of that board. All we could see were chains. Ruhi laka al-fida. But brothers and sisters, the commotion that created with all the tactfulness of the Khalifa, the circumstances changed. One of the Abbasids had to buy expensive clothing to put on the noble body of your Imam. With full respect, Musa ibn Ja'far was buried outside of Baghdad. لا يومك يومك يا أبا عبد الله. 3 days, the noble headless body of your Imam lying in the plains of Karbala.
ألا لعنة الله على القوم الظالمين وسيعلم الذين ظلموا أي منقلب ينقلبون. اللهم إنا نسألك وندعوك باسمك العظيم الأعظم الزهراء وأبيها وبعلها وبنيها والسر المستودع فيها بك يا الله 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 يا رحمن يا رحيم يا مقلب القلوب ثبت قلوبنا على دينك وعلى محبة أوليائك. Allah, we ask you by the right of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far that you hasten the return of our Imam. This is the greatest need we have. Allow us to see our Imam. Allow us to speak to our Imam. Allow us to hear our Imam. Allow us to be his true and close companions, those who fulfill all his commands, those who give all they have in his way. Ya Allah, prolong the life of and protect all those helping the cause of Islam, all the ones fighting for Islam, for true Islam, especially the Maraja and especially our beloved leader. Ya Allah, on these nights of the month of Ramadan, we ask you, forgive us all of our sins. Forgive our parents, our grandparents, our relatives, all believers, those who are alive, those who've left this world. Ya Allah, we all have hajat, we have needs. We have requests. There may be brothers and sisters suffering from illnesses in this crowd of brothers and sisters. We have relatives that are suffering. There are other believers, friends, acquaintances, those whom we do not know of. Ya Allah, by the right of Babul Hawa'ij Musa ibn Ja'far, we ask you to cure all the ill of the believers. Grant all believers their hajjats, relieve all of them from difficulties and hardships. Ya Allah, the shurur and the evils in Iraq caused by the enemies of Islam, we ask you that you, as soon as possible, tonight even, relieve the believers in that region from the problems they're facing. Ya Allah, we ask you, by the right of the Imam of our time, that you relieve all the people of the world of the oppression they're facing. Let's all recite together Dua al-Faraj. Allahumma kun waliyak al-Hujjat ibn al-Hasan salawatuka alayhi wa ala abaihi fi hadhihi as-sa'ah
وفي كل ساعة وليا وحافظا وقائدا وناصرا ودليلا وعينا حتى تسكنه أرضك طوعا وتمتعه فيها طويلا بالنبي وآله رحم الله من قرأ الفاتحة مع الصلوات.